Okay, so let's start. First of all, are there any questions about the homework? Or I guess the homework is due today. How did people find the homework? How many people thought this was educational and reasonable? How many people thought it was bad in some serious way that you want to tell me about? That it was too open-ended, it was boring, it was too hard. Any complaints at this moment? Or we'll see what happens when we grade it, but just to check that out. Okay, very good. There will be more of it to come, but not today. Okay? Any questions about any of the topics we've been talking about, string comparison? So we've been spending the last three lectures talking about string comparison and homology search. Any questions about that? The last class we talked a little bit about dynamic programming. We talked about the Smith-Waterman algorithm for comparing sequences. Any questions about that? Like someone would like to see it again, or any questions about dynamic programming? Okay. We've looked at a bunch of dynamic programming algorithms that are for string comparison that, with the exception of one of the gaps cases, all ran in order n times m time, where n was the length of the sequence, first sequence, and m was the length of the other sequence. But one issue we haven't talked about is how much space does dynamic programming take up? How much computer memory do you need in order to run the dynamic programming algorithms? Okay? So as a function of sequence length, how much space does it, memory does it take to do dynamic programming, to do Smith-Waterman? Okay? What, n times m? Why is it n times m? Well, because the heart of our dynamic programming problems, okay, when we're using dynamic programming, is that we are building a table, okay, where the table is going to be a table entry, ij, for every prefix of the first string and prefix of the second string. And so that was going to make for an algorithm that ran in n squared, n times m space, okay, quadratic memory. Now, quadratic memory is a very bad thing if you're actually trying to implement an algorithm for large problems, okay? So, for example, let's take quadratic space is much worse than quadratic time. So suppose, let's say, you wanted to do an alignment of two strings, okay, where each was 30,000 characters long. That is, you know, the size of a virus or something like that. That's not an unreasonable, that's not that big a size organism. But 30,000 squared is going to be equal to, how much is 30,000 squared? Is that 1 billion? Okay, I can never do this in my head. So I'd say 30,000, okay, I'd add 4 more zeros, and I convert this to a 10, a 9. And now what we've got here is something that's almost up to 900 million, close to a billion, okay, steps. So n squared for 30,000 is going to be about a billion. If you build a table where each entry takes one byte, which is the smallest sort of reasonable memory you could possibly use, okay, that would be 1 gigabyte. Okay, if you use real integers, it's going to be 4 gigabytes already. So, how many people here have computers that have memories of size 1 gigabyte? Okay, a few, which is sort of embarrassing because I don't. Okay, but some of you might, but you don't have computers with 10 gigabytes on it. Okay, so this is about the limit of the size memory that you're likely to have on a reasonable computer. Okay, so if you're doomed to doing a quadratic space algorithm, you are not doomed that your algorithm cannot possibly work beyond 30,000 by 30,000, okay, or so. Maybe it's 50,000, maybe it's 100,000, but it's still reasonably small. Now notice a billion, 30,000 by 30,000 is about 1 billion. Now 1 billion instructions per second is what your computer does. So, something on the order of a billion instructions per second, it depends how you want to count it, but letting a program run longer, you can always, if you're willing to, just if your constraint is time, if you let a program run for a day instead of a second, you know, you get another 3,000 times as much operations, and so you can potentially deal with an n squared algorithm if you won't let it run a day or a week or something like this. But it's clear that when it comes to memory, okay, you're stuck once you go beyond the main memory of your computer. Okay? And so the dynamic programming methods we've talked about are sort of doomed to failure or doomed to problems once you start talking about reasonably large tables. Okay? Any questions about that? It's important to have a feel for where things go bad. Okay, and I would say 30,000 is about where things go bad. But the question is, do we really need to keep the whole table in memory in order to do our dynamic programming algorithms? Okay? Thinking back to our edit distance computation, do we really need to keep the entire memory table around in order to figure out, let's say, what the edit distance of two springs is? The answer is no. And why not? Okay? Right, so the important point was that our dynamic programming algorithms typically work as follows. That while we were building this matrix, every element in the dynamic program depended upon the elements just to the left of it, just above it, and just above to the left of it. So each element depended. In order to compute it, we needed three other values. Suppose we filled a table cruising along rows like this. How many rows do we need worth of information in order to compute a particular cell? I'll claim that we only need two rows. If we just want to compute the edit distance, okay? If we want to, let's say, find what is the actual edit distance, the actual number, the smallest number of changes we need, we know that we're ultimately interested in the value of this cell down here. We're computing it on a row-by-row basis. We'll never need to look more than one row behind. In fact, this observation lets you use, instead of using n times m space, you get to use either n, 2 times n space, okay, if you want to compute the edit distance. Okay, does that solve our space problems? Okay, so some people say yes. I'm going to say the answer is no. Okay, it does solve the space problems in a practical sense, that if you could do it in order n space, then, you know, if you want to compare, you know, if you now tell me that your computer had a gigabyte worth of memory, well, then in principle you could store something approaching the entire length of the human genome in 1 gigabyte. Okay? So, I mean, maybe it's not, you know, I guess the human genome is 3 billion bases long. So 3 gigabytes in principle gives you enough gigabytes that if you got away with 1 byte per cell, you could work with very, you know, extremely large springs. But my question is, does this algorithm, when we throw away members of, you know, basically throw away everything except the last 2 rows, does that suffice to tell us everything we want to know about our computation? What is missing if we do this? The traceback. Okay? We will know what the cost of the optimal edit distance alignment is. But suppose you now want to figure out what are the changes you need to make, the sequence of changes you need, in order to edit this string into that string. How did we go and compute this? Well, we started from, ideally we kept track of parent pointers, okay, and then walked back to parent pointers. But if we write the same space, we don't have room for a whole matrix, an n by n matrix of parent pointers. You threw out everything but the last 2 rows. From each cell, how did we walk back and trace it back? We looked at the 3 cells, figured which was the better option that took us here. Walk backwards. Well, if you throw out all of the last 2 rows, you fall off a cliff very quickly. Okay? And there's no place to walk. You don't know how to get back to the starting position. So although it's possible to keep track of the edit distance, if you throw away the rows, okay, the table entries, it seems that you cannot reconstruct the path back. Is that sort of clear? Okay? I'm going to show you something that's kind of amazing and slick afterwards. Okay, but it's important to see what the problem is. Okay, because the solution is a little bit complicated. Okay, but it's important to see what the problem is. If we want to do large dynamic programs, we can't afford quadratic memory. If we don't keep track of every cell, maybe, but we can keep finding, just remember where the largest one was, or the ones that we're interested in. So it might be that if you're just interested in the value, okay, that you get from the computation, you can easily throw away most of the table. But if you actually want to trace things back, it looks like you need the entire table. Okay? And we now need to do something very, very clever if we're going to try to reconstruct the trace back without the entire table. Okay? Any questions? Yes, question. Okay, so you want to say that one way to solve it is to buy a bigger computer, or buy a computer with a big disk, and put the table on the disk. I would argue a couple of things. First of all, moving that much n squared data to the disk is going to be a complicated business, an expensive business. Okay? And second, once it's sitting on your disk, even going back and accessing it, each time you do another step backwards, you're going to get a page hit or something like this. You know, you might be able to play games with virtual memory or start slapping it on a disk, but you're still living dangerously. You have a quadratic space requirement. If we get rid of the quadratic space requirement, we're living a lot cleaner. Yes?
Three billion squared
is a big disk, okay? So 3 billion squared is big. 3 billion squared is actually a big amount of computer time in the beginning. I don't know how many. 3 billion squared, if we can do 1 billion operations per second, how many seconds are we talking about? Something like 10 billion seconds. How many years is 10 billion seconds? It's a lot, okay? So trying to do something that's a quadratic time operation where it's the size of the human genome, there time starts to be an issue, okay? But space is clearly an issue before time gets to be an issue. That should be sort of clear in your head, okay? That there is certainly a space where you will die of quadratic space, you know, a certain sort of set of parameters that you will die because you run out of space before you run out of your ability to wait. By 3 billion squared, you have run out of your ability to wait, okay? But as well. Any questions? Okay?
So the question really is now, is there a way that we can figure out the traceback data, okay, so that we can still spend only order the smaller of n and m space, still spend only n times n time, and yet reconstruct what the optimal alignment is as well. Okay? And there's a very, very slick
recursive idea, okay, for reducing space and dynamic programming. It's due to a man named Hirschberg. And what it's going to do is it's going to, in some sense, compute the dynamic program more than once, but recompute only the parts that we know that we need. Okay?
So what are we going to do? It's probably easier to see it as a picture than to try to read my explanation. Suppose that when we do our dynamic program, we don't keep store the whole table. But we do store or keep track of, for every cell computation that we're working on, remember, like the normal dynamic programming, we're going to go fill in the rows along this way. We're going to depend upon our two previous values, which is here. Okay? And we're going to fill it in, but we're going to keep one extra bit of information, one extra integer of information, one extra field worth of information on every cell. Namely, we're going to want to know for every cell we compute out here, where did we cross the center line of our matrix? Okay? So here we've got a matrix that is, you know, this matrix, if you wish, is n by m. The optimal alignment has a property that is going to be a walk from the beginning, let's say for head and distance. Although this kind of trick can be used for other things, but doing global alignment. We know that the optimal distance, head and distance, from the two springs is going to be described as a walk through our matrix, where we're always going down or diagonally or to the right. So we never go up and down. There's no operation that takes us backwards, right? Okay? Every operation is either going to be a matter of substitution, which was a diagonal move, or a deletion or an insertion. We know that the path has the property that it's always going down and to the right, correct? What I'm going to do now, and we know that every cell in here depends upon, basically, has a predecessor. Okay, that in order to compute this value, its value depended upon a predecessor, correct? That's how we can, if we have the pointers, walk back to reconstruct the entire trace, right? Now, every cell that we compute, instead of keeping track of its parent, is going to keep track of what row did we cross the center line in. Okay? So for this particular cell, the one thing I don't want to know who my parent is, I want to know what was the row number where I crossed the center line. Okay? And I claim that I'm going to now augment mine. I'm going to keep track of only two rows of my dynamic programming matrix, likely just trying to keep track of cost. But now instead of keeping track of just the parent, instead of just the value, I'm also going to keep track of, in getting to here, what was the cell that the place where I crossed the center axis. So what does that mean? Again, to fill in this cell, I took the best of three possibilities. Each one of these three possibilities knows what to get to that place. Where did I cross the center axis? So when I decide I'm going to be doing a substitution, I take this guy's crossing the center axis. An insertion, I take this guy's. Deletion, I take that guy's. Okay? My claim is that if I do that, I can propagate it down. For this particular cell, I will know exactly what row did I cross the center axis. Does everybody believe that I can find that information, keep that information? May not be clear what good it is, but... What does it matter here? All these I'll say I don't cross any place. So this is completely uninteresting to me now, because I've never crossed that axis. Okay? But for all these cells, I know I had to cross that axis. Okay? So I'm going to keep track of either the first one that did it or the last one that did it, whichever I prefer. Okay? Because it could be that I hit the axis, cruise down for a while before going back. Okay? But I'm only going to keep that for one cell. Okay? Does everybody see that I can do that? I mean, I see what good it is. But tell me now, what good is knowing where I cross the middle axis now if I want to reconstruct the path? Okay? Yeah?
Look for all those cells which have been dropped off the same distance, and that will be possible.
Well, what I know, I say all the cells that cross that thing, it doesn't make any. The only cells that I haven't thrown away are in the last two rows. So all these guys go and they cross the middle axis. But that doesn't give me enough information to reconstruct the whole path. Okay? Yeah? What I know now is 100% right. What I now know is, I know where my path crossed the center axis. I know where the path crossed the center axis here. Okay? I know that my path is always going down and to the left. I'll claim that once I know that the optimal path crossed at this cell, I know that the only locations in the matrix that I'm interested in are those and that the judge to complete the job of reconstructing the path. I need to find the path from here to here and from here to here. Correct? I know a little step in my path. If I can now go back and reconstruct the path up to that little step and from that little step, I'm done. How can I do that? I'm now going to go and recursively do the same thing. And now go back and recompute this matrix with this, the middle of this column, as my new center line. And recompute this part of the matrix from the center line and figure out where the middle point is in there. Okay? And by recursively doing this recomputation, I will figure out what were the center points I encountered and keep dividing it finer. I claim that I can now reconstruct the path at the cost of doing more computation, of recomputing parts of the matrix I computed the first time. Okay? Does everybody sort of see that I can do that? Okay, that will give me a correct answer. It may be taken away, but it doesn't seem to seem wasteful. You're doing a lot of recomputation. Well, how wasteful is it? Let's stop and think about it. How many cells did I compute in my first pass through the whole matrix? I did order n times n work, right? Because I filled in n times n squares. How many squares will I look at in the second phase? Okay. I will be looking at half the cells. Why? Because if I'm throwing out some of my matrix, how much the matrix that is below the dividing line and above that line, how much of the matrix do I throw out? Well, part of it, you may say, depends upon where I cross that center column. But not really. Okay? If I crossed it up at the very top, what did I do? I kept this one line, and I kept that whole matrix. But I threw out all this. If I crossed it one line lower, I threw out two columns here and one column there. Do you see that as my center line crossing point marches down? I have an extra half row here, but I lose a half row here. So at all points, no matter where you cross that thing, I threw out half the cells. Does everybody agree with that? So what's going to happen? At each level of recurrence, I'm throwing out half the cells. Right? So how much total work am I doing? Okay, it's governed by this magic series. I'm doing n times m divided by 2 to the I work per iteration, where I goes from 0 to log n. Okay, you see that I'm sort of building a tree and constantly splitting it. Okay? At each layer, I'm doing half as much work as on the previous layer, right? Everybody sort of see that? Now, what does that mean for the total cost? You factor this thing out, the MN out, you get the sum of 1 over 2 to the I. Does everybody remember that series? What does the series, the sum of I as we go from 1, sum of 1 over 2 to the I, as we go from I equals 0 to I equals anything? What is that going to come out to?
1 minus 2 to the I.
Well, 1 minus 2 to the, it's going to be less than 2. That's the important thing. Okay? If I did it up to infinity, it would be 2. So in fact, I'm only doing twice as much work, okay, in reconstructing the path that I would have done with the naive dynamic programming. Okay? And I get to throw out the whole matrix, okay, by simply reconstructing it in that smart way. Any questions about that? Okay? This to me is kind of an amazing thing, and it's a very, very useful thing. If anybody is going to do any kind of dynamic programming on large, on any reasonably sized problems, this is the way it is done. Okay? Because you eliminate the quadratic amount of memory, you can reconstruct whatever you want from there.
Any questions? Do people see, how do people believe in their bones that this still takes quadratic time? Okay? How many people don't believe it yet? Don't see why it takes, why are we not spending more time? How many people are just confused? I've seen a lot of people staring at me. Nobody, okay? Any questions, comments? Okay? So, again, this series converges. Again, when you were in high school, you saw series, what happened when you hit some of the geometric series. Think of it like an American football, where you could hit a penalty near the goal line. I don't know how much of this will clarify too many people here. But in football, you could hit a penalty halfway, close to the goal line, within 20 yards of the goal line. Every time you do something bad, they move the ball halfway to the goal line. Right? So the distance you get is half for your first bad thing, half for your second bad thing, half for your second bad, third bad thing, half for the fourth bad thing. How many times do you have it till you cross the goal line? Well, you never cross the goal line. Okay? And that is really what this is sort of saying. That when you sum up these fractions, you're still basically getting one or two. Okay? And so the total cost you get is still quadratic in the size of the, basically linear in the size of the memory, the number of cells in the matrix. Any questions? Okay?
So together, when you use this kind of a trick with the Smith-Waterman algorithms that we had before, takes quadratic time and only linear memory. Okay? And yet you can reconstruct what you need as you need it. Any last questions? A dynamic programming. Okay, that's all I want to say about dynamic programming at this point. So if there's any other questions about dynamic programming or string comparison or sequence comparison, speak now or hold your peace. Okay? Very good. Now, I said I'm not going to talk more about dynamic programming, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to talk more about string comparison. Okay? That we've talked a lot about using dynamic programming to align sequences. In fact, probably the most important sequence comparison alignment programs do not use dynamic programming as the big thing that makes them work. Okay? And the reason should sort of be obvious from what we're talking about when we talked about the impact of quadratic time. Okay? Dynamic programming methods for sequence alignment give you the best quality results. And when you have two sequences you really have to align, then you use Smith-Waterman or something like that. Now, the trouble is that when you try to compare two very long strings using dynamic programming and a quadratic time algorithm, again, when I did the size of the human genome, okay, do a quadratic algorithm of that. Let's say comparing human against mouse. They're both about 3 billion base pairs long. At 1 billion operations per second, that is 285 years. Okay? So maybe you could buy 285 computers and do it in parallel, but it would still take you a year to do that kind of computation. So it's, trying to use dynamic programming to compare extremely large strings or to search large databases of strings is a hopeless task. Okay? And if you think about it, the way that biologists work, okay, how many people here are familiar with BLAST? A few honest biologists. Okay? What happens in a real laboratory is that you have some sequence you're interested in. Gee, I want to know, I just went into my lab and I sequenced this part of a chimpanzee. I have a little chimpanzee sequence. And I want to know what it does. Where is it in the entire database of billions of bases of sequences that are known? Okay? You need a rough answer quickly. Okay? And in order to do that, basically, there are heuristic programs, or I'll call heuristic search algorithms. Namely, BLAST and FASTA are the two most famous ones that are very good at scanning large sequence databases and telling you roughly where it works. Okay? So this is the way that the first level screening is done, is with the heuristic search programs. And then later on, to polish it, once you really know what two things you want to see how they align, then you would do a Smith-Waterman. Any questions? So I'd like to talk a little, spend the rest of today talking about these heuristic search algorithms. Okay? And heuristic search algorithms, when a computer scientist or an algorithm person says that you have a heuristic algorithm, what it usually meaning is that it means a sort of a dirty, fuzzy, not very interesting thing. Okay? Because these programs, they don't give you any, in some sense, any provable behavior. They don't guarantee they will find all matches in some rigorous, guaranteed way. What they do is they take on a very difficult problem, namely how do you search a huge database and get an answer quickly, okay, at the loss of perhaps certain theoretical properties. So the two heuristic algorithms we'll look at, FastA and BLEST, okay, basically work in the following kind of a manner. Okay? If you have two sequences that are quite similar to each other, okay, at least locally, you would expect that there's a region of high local similarity. There is probably a long run of characters, or a reasonable length run of characters, that are the same in both strings. Okay? So, if you're trying to compare, if they are a gene of length 100, you're going to look at two long sequences. And you want to say, in this, these two long sequences, is there a conserved region, let's say a gene of 100 bases, that is the same in both species up to some level of mutations? If they're not too far apart, then probably there is an exact match of some sort of sequences there. If there is no reasonably long exact match, then they can't be too good in any exact match, right? Suppose we have two strings that don't have any exact match of more than one between them. That was something like A star, A star, A star, aligning that with A. We could align a string of all A's against the string A star, A star, A star, by deleting every other character. There is no long common substring. But on the other hand, it's also not a very similar set of sequences, right? You have to delete half the characters in order to make them match. So the basic rule of these heuristic algorithms is that they try to work on the basis of building a library or a hash table of short exact matches, but also of sequences of length k, with the property, just like on one of your homework property problems. You want to pick a k such that, in comparing two sequences, it is large enough that you do not get too many spurious hits. That if two strings that you're trying to compare share a k-mer, it is probably somewhat interesting. Setting k equals to 1, asking if two sequences share a base in common, is not going to be very interesting, right? Every single DNA sequence in the world of length 20 or more has an A, a C, a G, and a T. Okay? So what you want is to have a large enough K such that you get a relatively few number of hits by random, but small enough that even if the two sequences are somewhat distantly, have had some mutation between them, there's some distance between them, that there will be a match of that length, okay? So we can sort of hash it in a database. So in the FastA implementation, the standard default is that if you want to search for protein sequences, which are on a base 20 alphabet, okay, they recommend setting k equals to 2, and for a DNA, they recommend setting k equals to 6. Okay? So what is the chance that two positions in A, how many different possibilities for two base protein sequences are there? 20 times 20, something like about 400 possibilities. How many differences for DNA? What's 4 to the 6?
What is 4 to the 6th? I can't do that. I'm standing up. Not 4 million, I hope not. 4 to the 6th is... What? 4096. Okay? So if you think about it, what is this really saying?
That the odds of a spurious hit, you think about it, if I give you a random sequence of length, if I have a particular sequence of length K, it will happen roughly, if I have a random DNA sequence, it'll happen, this occurrence will occur by chance, roughly one out of every 4,000 bases. Right? Does everybody sort of agree with that? Ballpark figure? Okay? Every six pairs is going to start, okay, at some position. Is 4 to the 6th possible six pair? Okay? Something like every 4,000 bases or so, okay, is where you will see that one. In a protein, something like about 1 out of every 200 protein C bases, you will have that exact match by chance. So these are not very low, but not very high either. Okay? So what are we going to do?
We're going to build a database, basically build a hash table, where
for every one of the target strings, okay, the 4 to the 6th target helix, the 4 to the 6th possibilities for DNA or the 20 squared possibilities for amino acids, we're going to keep a list of, let's say my database, my sequence database, is broken down into a bunch of different files, okay, where each file is a Gentile diagram, okay, maybe a human chromosome, maybe some sequence thing. I can now have a hash table where I have a link for every six-mer of DNA. I have a list of all the files that contain that six-mer. Okay? Now, suppose I want to compare two sequences. Okay? Two long sequences. Or maybe compare one long sequence against the dictionary. I'm now going to try to find every six-mer in my DNA sequence. Look it up in my hash table. Get a list of all documents, all GenBank file entries, if you will, that have that six-mer in it. And then, if I have a six-mer, if I have one of the files occurs often enough that there's enough six-mer that are in common between it and my sequence, then that is something that is worth investigating more closely. Okay? And so the basic idea of the FASTA heuristic is that we're going to hash these six-mers, look for exact matches, okay? And then, once we know where the exact matches are, if there's enough matches between a particular file and a particular, or a particular region in our database, and the input sequence, then we will go do a more careful analysis, a dynamic programming-like thing, on the matches that occurred. Okay? And that's the way FASTA works. Any questions? It should seem very plausible, okay? But you should realize that you're missing things, potentially. There's no guarantee that this is going to find everything, okay? But on the other hand, there is a guarantee that this can be pretty fast, okay? You can make it as fast as you want by making K as high as you want, right? Because if you demand if you set K equal to 10 or 12 or 15, okay, the odds that you're going to get a match of that long a string in common, by chance, it's going to become very, very small, right? So your hash table here will become very, very large, and there'll be very, very few files that contain it. And so by setting this large enough, you can make your search arbitrarily fast. And at this point, it becomes an engineering issue. Can you make it, you know, how do you trade off speed for sensitivity? Okay? Any questions? Okay? Hashing, this idea of hashing is a very important idea in computer science. We talked about suffix arrays earlier in the course. And I mentioned that suffix arrays was developed by this guy, Gene Myers. His co-author was a guy named Udi Manberg.
okay, who is now the chief scientist at Yahoo. Okay, so he was a string algorithms person, an honest string algorithms person, who became the chief scientist at Yahoo. And I heard him give a talk about, you know, algorithmic implications of Yahoo. Yahoo has these huge databases and stuff like this. And he was talking to an audience of algorithms people. And someone asked him, what are the three most important algorithms in Yahoo? He said, hashing, hashing, and hashing. Okay? That basically this idea of building a table where you, you know, do exact matches on sort of small parts of it, okay, is a very, very powerful idea for sort of filtering your search so that you get your search down to a small number of places where the documents might be. Undoubtedly, Google does a similar thing, okay? That the way you can search billions of documents at once is by not searching billions of documents, okay? By searching for, you know, sort of words or common strings and then doing an analysis of the indices, okay? And that's basically what FastA is doing. Any questions? Okay? Bless! It, oh, question, yes.
Do you have the machinery database
like this? Mm-hmm.
With a number of
inputs?
Yes.
Specifics,
can you change?
Right, so in order for you to do very, very fast search, that's a good point. The idea behind one of these hash table lookups or these database searches is you're going to spend some time pre-processing the database in order to make it easier for you to answer other queries. That's sort of the critical idea here, okay? You know that the GenBank, okay, you know, you get it, there's a new release every once in a while, okay? Or there's new sequences every day, but the vast bulk of GenBank or the vast bulk of the sequence database you want to search for is the same day to day. So what you want to do is you're willing to spend a certain amount of time to build an index into that database to help you search for, when you have another target query, you want that answer to be fast. You're willing to spend, you know, potentially a lot of time to build your database so that you can search it quickly. Okay? Now, building a hash table is not that expensive. Okay, but it does take time proportional to the size of the database. You have to hash the entire text that you're looking at. Okay? But once you've done that for GenBank, then if you give it a query sequence, potentially, you know, you only have to look at a very small fraction of the database before answering it. That's the idea behind these database schemes.
They have sometimes.
They have done that, right.
And so they have done that for some simplification.
Yes. Right, all right, so what they've done is, when you build the database, you need to know what K is. The person who's building the database. The person who's searching the database does not have to know what K is.
So you guys are able to change K if you want?
Well, if you want to change K, you, the searcher, can't do it. But you, the database administrator, can do it, okay? So if you really want to muck with these parameters, these are publicly available software. You could get the database, get a local copy of the database. You get a local copy of the parameter of the software. You could change that constant and remake it, okay? In general, I would say you as a biologist are not going to care too much what the value of K is. You're going to care what the quality of the sequence comparisons and alignments you get out of it are. This setting of this hash table is really just an internal trick to trade off between space, between time and quality. Okay? And if they pick these parameters for a reason, you probably don't want to mess with it. Okay? The goal is to pick parameters that are just rare enough that an occurrence of them is interesting, and yet not so rare that you can allow some tolerance and you're still going to have a string that long in common. Any questions? Okay? So BLEST is probably the most famous sequence comparison tool. Okay? It is BLEST. First of all, I think BLEST has a great acronym. Okay? It stands for Basic Local Alignment Search Tool.
You know, they probably stayed up late that night thinking about that. That's a good acronym. SPEED. It signifies speed, and it also signifies that it's doing alignment. Like FASTA, it's going to try to combine, basically do a hashing kind of a scheme, where they're going to build a database of KMERS, all the KMERS that occur anywhere in the database, okay? In any of the strings, those will be sort of stored in a hash table. So you can look up where in all that sequence database are there sequences that contain a particular pattern. Blast's trick is a little bit different, though. They are not going to be looking for exact matches, okay? The hash table is going to store exact matches of size K. They want to allow inexact searches against the exact hash table. Which, if you think about it, you can't really do. If you have a hash table that's indexed according to a particular pattern, you can't look it up according to part of that pattern, because that's not how hash tables are arranged. What they do is the following. Given your input query, which is probably fairly small, okay, they're going to take every KMER in your input and convert it into a list of KMERS that are of sequences of length K that are close to the one that are in your input. Okay? So let's say that you want to allow some inexact matching. You want to look up A. In the database, gee, does this occur anywhere in a noisy way? Okay? What they did is they built a hash table on the entire dictionary with the exact KMERS as indices. What Blast does is it takes your sequence, breaks it into KMERS, overlapping KMERS, and for each KMER, will submit queries to the database. Say not in their exact match to this, but maybe we'll try all possible one-based substitutions of that pattern. So let's say your first K characters of your sequence may have been all A's. Maybe it will submit the back the query all A's, it will submit the query all A's with a T at the end, all A's with a G at the end, all A's with a... And it will look up for all these exact matches. So since you're now doing queries which are KMERS of yours that are close to KMERS of your sequence, you get a certain amount of noise tolerance, okay, which you wouldn't get with FASTA. And then you can exploit this fact to use a larger window size, okay, in building your dictionary. So what Blast does basically is, instead of having a window of size 6, they will allow a window size of size 12. What is for DNA 4 to the 12? What is 4 to the 12? Okay, that's a lot. That's 16 million. So there's 16 million possible 12-mers of DNA. Okay? So, an exact match of size 12 is a very, you know, very impressive thing. So impressive it probably won't happen in distantly related sequences. But in order to get a greater degree of noise tolerance, they're going to submit queries to it of not the exact KMER that was at the input. They're all KMERs that are within a distance, a short, small distance of the input KMER. And then based on how many files it sort of matches up with, how many hits in the hash table you get, how good they are, you make a decision to search more. Yeah. What is Q? I do not know. This is T of Q. I would say that it's probably going to be something like 1 or 2. Okay? It's not going to be larger than 2 or so. Okay? And again, it's an engineering issue. Having K be large is good because it makes your database, any hit a much more meaningful thing. On the other hand, you don't want to miss too many things. Okay? So it's an engineering issue. Okay? Conventional wisdom says that BLAST is faster than FASTA. Okay? But some people say less accurate. Okay? So a real good biologist might say, well, if I'm going to do a search, I'll start doing it with BLAST, and then the things that it hits on, maybe I'll investigate them more closely with FASTA. Okay? Any questions? Yes? So it should be clear that there's two different kinds of errors you can make. One kind of error you can make is, gee, the sequence really is in the database. You know, you type in the gene for insulin, okay? And it comes back and says, insulin doesn't exist, okay? That is an error that the sequence is there, but you didn't find it. Another kind of error you could make is that you type in a sequence and you get back all kinds of junk that is not related in an evolutionary way with what you're looking for. So, you know, so it's sort of a difficult question to answer how accurate these things are in some ways. How do you know if you're not missing? If it's easy to see when you're getting back junk. A biologist can get back a list of homologies and say, these are all ridiculous, they don't mean anything. But if it comes back and says there's no answer, you tend to believe it. Okay? So, you know, it's clear that it's a bit of an engineering decision here. Okay? And how good are they? Well, again, it's a little bit of a heuristic thing. This is why I don't like to deal with heuristics. Okay? It's sort of a messy thing. On the other hand, this is clearly an incredibly useful thing. Okay? That BLAST has been probably the most important contribution of computer science and computing to biology. Okay? So this BLAST is used, by I would say 100,000 people every day, and it's used. It represents the tremendous load of cycles. Okay, I mean a lot of people are using BLAST. Okay, so it is very important. But again, it's a bit of an art. It's an engineering issue. Any questions? So what I wanted to do was to talk a little bit about what it's like to use BLAST. Okay, so I've shown you how the theory of it works. Okay, it's based on these tamer matches. But what happens when you try to use it? So if you use BLAST, if you go on the web, the National Institute of Health has a BLAST server. Okay? BLAST, the software is available, and the databases are available for downloading. So if you want to run BLAST, you can buy a computer. Download the database and download the software and run it on your home computer, or your lab computer, or your network of lab computers. And that is probably what most serious BLAST users do. Today I did an example, I did a little BLAST search over the web, and when I typed in my query, it came back immediately with a blinking thing saying your query will take 26 minutes to answer, because there's other people ahead of you in the queue. Okay? So you can use a public BLAST server at this place, or you can download the software and use it on your own machine. There's several variations of the basic BLAST code, depending upon whether or not you want to... BLAST is a very highly optimized program. It's very important that it runs as fast as it can. And there's different versions of it, depending upon which database or sequence comparison you want to make. So, the first version, BLAST-P, is a way to do amino acid sequence comparisons to a protein sequence database. Okay? Now, how would such a thing work? Okay? If I gave you the amino acid sequence to protein sequence, this means that the query sequence is a base 20 alphabet. The database sequences are a base 20 alphabet. Okay, it's clear it's just a pattern matching the way that we've talked about it before. BLAST N is a nucleotide sequence query against a nucleotide sequence database. That's clearly the kind of exact pattern matching that we've done before. BLAST X, the input is a DNA sequence, and it's going to be searching against a protein database. How would you convert a DNA sequence query to a protein query? Well, you use that triplet code translation table that we talked about. So, this BLAST thing, you give it a DNA sequence. It will start from the first character and translate it into a protein alphabet, three bases at a time.
It will move into one character, translated into a floating alphabet, three bases at a time. It will move in two characters, translated into three bases at a time, and compare all of these amino acid sequences against the protein sequence database. Okay, does everybody see that? There's three possible frames. You don't know where the start is. So it searches all three frames in the translation. Any questions? Okay, yes. Right, so if you have a, let's say in your DNA sequence, let's say that you had had a deletion mistake. When you were sequencing it, you actually forgot one base in the middle. Now you've got a frame shift error. So if you try to look up proteins in here, the interpretation of the protein will get all messed up once you cross that deletion or insertion boundary. So that certainly is a problem. This shows that when you think about the kind of mutations that can happen as DNA sequences evolve, you know, there's all kinds of bad things that can happen in mutations. The most common mutation is probably one of these point mutations, where we change an A to a C, let's say, or something like that. That is not going to really change the protein too much, right? It's going to change it by at most one residue, okay? But what happens if it's then there's a mutation and another letter comes in, another base gets stuck in, a replication error? Now if that happens in the middle of a gene, the entire part of the entire gene after that point is completely messed up. So these kinds of mutations are serious events. Usually they will break the protein completely if the organism will do so well. Or it might, if you get very lucky, be a big enough change that it will cause some kind of an interesting evolutionary change. So a point mutation can lead to a big change. I mean, insertion mutation can lead to a big change in a protein. Point mutations lead to relatively small changes. Okay? Both these suggestions.
Sometimes we get it's like a lot more alignment for the start of the document. And then also running the alignment for the second part of the problem. Give some significant that based on the
But that's another reason why we're usually interested in local alignments. Remember, Smith-Waterman was a local alignment program, not a global alignment program. So suppose you would insert your DNA sequence where you happen to have had a mistake and deleted a base in the middle of your gene. What is often the case is that you had a high protein match with the first part and a high protein match with the second part. Okay? And then that would lead you to believe, oh, look, there's probably something interesting happening here. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So you compare it against that. What are the other flavors here? You can compare a protein query sequence against a DNA sequence database, again, by translating the you can translate the protein sequence into a DNA and compare against that. Or, in the most intensive way to do it, suppose you take as input a DNA sequence and you want to compare it against a DNA database. What you can sometimes do is people will compare the six possible translations of the input the query DNA sequence against the six possible translations of the nucleotide sequence database. So what does this mean? Suppose as input you have an amino acid sequence, A, C, T, 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 G. What are the possible gene interpretations, amino acid sequences, that might be interpreted from this DNA sequence? Well, we agree that it might start from the first position, or it might start from the second position, or it might start from the third position. That gives three possible interpretations. Where are the other three possible interpretations of this DNA sequence? Yes. The complement. You know, when you get this DNA sequence, you don't know which of the two strands it may or may not have occurred on. And some genes occur on the top strand of the double helix, and some genes occur on the bottom strand. So in this last layer, you take your input sequence, you convert it into three protein sequences, you also do the reverse complement of that sequence, and convert that into three translations, and see if there's any protein residue that hits this way against anything that can be built that way in the database. Okay? So these are different variations that you might, you know, depending on how serious you are, what you're looking for.
You may want to try that. Any questions? Another thing that BLAST gives you as an option when you try to run it is it asks you what DNA sequences do you want to compare it against. So when I looked at the BLAST server today, they gave me the following choices. One is the NR database for non-redundant, meaning that somebody went through, at least somewhat, went through a collection of databases and tried to select a somewhat non-redundant set of GenBank data. Remember, anybody can submit things to GenBank. People can submit lots and lots of copies of things to GenBank. People have gone from starting out with a sequence and updating it. So there's a lot of copies of things there. NR is an attempt to get all things that are basically not redundant. Okay? Another set of databases that they let you search are things called ESTs. ESTs are things called expressed sequence tags. Okay? And this reflects the fact that not all sequencing projects attempt to sequence the entire genome of an organism. Let's say that, you know, the most interesting part of a genome to a, let's say, a drug company, historically it was going to be the genes. The part of the DNA sequence that codes for proteins. I mentioned that the human genome was 3 billion bases long. What percentage of that is actual genes coding stuff? 2%, something like that. 1 out of every 50 bases. In sequencing the entire genome, in some sense, if all you really care about are the genes, okay, you're wasting a lot of 50%, you know, we're only using 2% of your effort is what you're really interested in. So is there a way just to sequence the genes of an organism without sequencing all the other stuff? And the answer is, sort of. Okay? We know that DNA goes to RNA goes to protein, right? That was our first example here. These proteins are, the RNAs are basically copies of the genes. Somebody has a bright idea, why don't I just take the RNA in a cell, okay, and basically sequence that. Sequence not the DNA, the genomic DNA, but these copies of RNA that are made in expressing the gene, okay, and just copy basically these, sequence the expression part of the genes, okay? And though these ESTs, basically, are the equivalent of the RNA that is expressed in a cell. So certain sequencing projects, before you try to do a whole genome sequencing, a way to get more back for your buck initially is to basically sequence the expressed genes, okay, the ESTs. And there are huge libraries of these things for mouse and humans and stuff like that. Okay, and so these libraries exist in GenBank as well, or in a BLAST. And so you can do your BLAST search against all published ESTs. Any questions? Any ideas why ESTs are, ESTs are a great idea, but they don't eliminate the need for doing whole genome sequencing. Why is that? What might be wrong with just sequencing the expressed RNA? So it could very well be that the only genes that are translated into RNA are those that are actively being expressed in the organism. Okay? So you have the gene that's actually turned on to make the protein. A lot of the genes in your, you know, in a cell, you know, in a genome, are not expressed all the time.
There's certain genes that are expressed almost all the time. But a lot of your genes are expressed only in under strange conditions. Okay? If we put you in an oven, we put you under heat stress, certain genes will be expressed that are not expressed when you're sitting in the classroom. Okay? When you give certain genes are only activated under very precise conditions. So if all you do is you take the cell, harvest the RNA that's happening in the cell right now, what you're likely to get are lots and lots of copies of RNA from the most commonly expressed genes, but not necessarily any transcripts from the uncommon genes. Does that make sense? Okay? In fact, an expression level of certain genes, like, you know, the fundamental protein, might be hundreds of thousands of times higher than the others. So by sequencing the ESPs, you get a good idea of the most heavily expressed genes. But you won't see the rare ones unless you sequence a huge number of ESPs and you put the cell under all kinds of different conditions. Okay? So ESPs are a good thing, but they're not everything. So there's databases of ESTs as well. Any questions? You can search against all the certain genomes that have already been sequenced. You can search against all the releases, the things that have been added to GenBank in the last month. Let's say you're a biologist who really cares about a particular gene. Okay, every month you may want to go back and run another blast search to see what's the latest thing that's come out, if anybody else has figured out what it does or something. So there's lots of different databases you might want to search for. When you try it, you get a, this is what happened when I tried my blast search. Okay, so I went today, actually maybe we should turn off that light to, maybe this is what it probably would have seen better without the light. So I went over the web today, and just as an example, I went to conduct a blast search. And this is what I did, was I typed in, and I could cut and paste 60 bases from the genome of HIV, which I happen to have sitting around on a disk for some reason. Okay, so I picked a random 60 bases of HIV. And this is what happened. So I got into my blast window on the web, I typed in these 60 bases, hit return. The first thing it did is it told me to wait 28 minutes. Okay, because there was the blast server was still overloaded. This is why people buy their own computers and run their things on their own desk. But 28 minutes later, I got the following web page back. Okay, first thing it had was a reference to sort of whose paper I should cite to say thank you for doing this blast search. Okay, and that's what this first thing is. The second thing it did is it told me that there were 100 that out of the, it looks like 6 billion bases that it searched, and the 1.5 million sequences it searched, it told me that there were 164 hits that scored well. It then gave me a list of all those sequences, okay? And if you look at it, sure enough, all those sequences were, again, there are different entry numbers, different files. Some of them were GenBank files, some of them they're EMBL files. Okay? All of them, if you look at it, are basically HIV sequences. Okay? So this told me that the basic sequence for HIV appeared 164 times in the supposedly non-redundant database. Okay? It also told us, gave us an E value. Okay? An E value is what? It's an expectation of how likely is it that a match this good occurred by chance. So here this is 3 times E to the, minus 25th. This is an extremely small value, right? So if you think about it, I mean, I was giving it a pretty easy query. I was typing in 60 bases of HIV. Okay? The odds of that occurring by chance, all of these basically match almost all the characters. If you look at it, this particular strain here, I think, had a 1 base difference from the one above it. So the score got slightly lower. But the odds of any of these matches happening by chance are vanishingly small, and it makes sense. I mean, again, it's always finding
Just about everything we see here is HIV. Not always. Here it looks like, actually, this one here, it says it's a cloning vector. Okay? This may or may not be I'm not a biologist, I don't know quite what it is. It seems a little surprising to me that people find that it's labeled as a cloning vector. But again, these are the entries that are in there. And my 164 alignments went all the way down to scores that were 3 to the minus 6, e to the minus 16. Okay, so these were deemed less good than the previous one, but still clearly very good. Then it gave me alignments for all pairs of those sequences. So here it compared my query sequence, aligned it against the sequence match that it had found. And since what I gave it was such an easy query, as you can see, the alignment was perfect. Okay, every base here matched every base in the TAR query sequence. That's why the score was so high. If I gave it if I had an error to my sequence, if I had, not given it such an easy query, my alignments would not be so good. And in fact, here were the quality of my lowest ranking alignments that it found. Okay, over here, as far as I can tell, why are these lower quality alignments? Well, if you look at it, it's a shorter match. So somehow a certain number of characters got knocked off from the left and the right. And also, if you look at it, there's a one base mismatch. Here was an A, here was a J. Okay? Again, if you gave it a harder query, you wouldn't expect such very good results. Okay? Or such dramatic results. Okay? Any questions? And what other thing? And then there's various other statistics here. But that's, I think, the main information that we got back from the query. Any questions? So, when you're doing a search against, a search against the database in BLAST, you get to specify certain parameters, so if you really know what you're doing, you can get better searches, you get better results. So one thing that you can do that I think that is sort of interesting is you can change the threshold of how good an expect score do you get in order to see the results. So if you looked at the examples that I showed you before, this E score, this expect score, was extremely low. Like I said, it was something like E to the minus 20th or something like that. You can specify what is the expect score, okay, the threshold for reporting how many matches you should get against the database, okay? The default threshold is that it will give you an E score of 10, meaning they're going to set the parameters internally so that you're expected to get 10 matches by chance. Now, in my particular database, I had so many good matches that were so far better than chance. It gave me 164 great matches and didn't give me anything, that was close. The default value in BLAST is that they set it so that you will get, for any query, expect to get 10 matches back by chance. Okay? And these would not be significant. Okay? But it was so you don't get too much junk back. If you want, you can lower that threshold to make it less likely you get junk back, but of course you're also less, there's also a greater chance you can actually miss the sequence that you want. Any questions? Another parameter they let you change is they let you add filters to delete sequences from being returned which have low computational complexity, compositional complexity. So we've seen that one thing that happens in genomes a lot are repeats, AT, 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 AT. Okay? These are usually not very interesting. But if you're looking for a gene that is, you're looking for a match that is quite far away from something, that is, at a fairly high evolutionary distance, there's always a chance that these repeats might be what gets returned as possible answers. So you're allowed to filter out and eliminate sequences that it deems as uninteresting because they're not very, very, they're not very complex. They just have repeats or something like that. The only thing you're allowed to change is the cost comparison matrix. Okay? We talked before about the PAM matrices and the BLOSSOM matrices. Depending upon how far away the distances sequences that you're looking for are, okay, if you expect an evolutionary distance, you would want to adjust the right comparison matrix so that you could use it to basically try to find sequences that mean something to you. So the BLOSSOM matrix that is the default is good at finding fairly long alignments. Okay? If you're looking for very, very short alignments, maybe short exact alignments, they recommend using the PAM matrices. Okay? Any questions? Okay? One thing that's a little bit interesting is the fact that you can select the matrix here after the database is built. Remember, there was a question earlier about, hey, do I need to know what K is when I build my database? Can I change that? What's interesting is you can change the cost matrix that you're building, that you're using to do the comparison, after the database is built. Because the basic operation you're doing against the database are exact comparisons, matching, does this sequence occur there? The matrix will help you interpret what the meaning of those things are. Okay? But otherwise, so you can use different matrices. Any questions? The final thing I want to say is just to discuss a little bit more about these significant scores. Okay? So, when you look at BLAST, one of the most important things that you get back from it is not just the name of the sequence that contains a match to your target. You get a score back saying how interesting a match does that seem to be, you know, how interesting is it that you got you got an alignment of that quality. With the Smith-Waterman algorithm, remember we had this idea that you were to get a local alignment that was going to have a score, and it was going to be a function of how many how good were the base comparison, the base matches, how few insertions, deletions, or gaps did you have. There's a certain score associated with that. As we talked about it before, it's sort of an ad hoc number. Oh, look, this local alignment had a score of 153. In order for something to be meaningful, you'd like to assign a statistical significance to a score. And so there's been a great deal of work by statisticians in trying to assign a meaning of a high score, of a BLAST score. What is if you have two sequences and they give you a score of 153, what does that mean? And the basic model is an equation that looks something like this. E, remember, was the expected number of matches you would get by chance if you were comparing two sequences, one of length M and one of length N. Okay? The expected number of matches was going to be basically the product of those times e to the minus lambda times that score. Lambda and k are parameters that you get set for your model. The interesting thing here is that as your score gets a little bit higher, s is the score, the expected number of matches you get with that score decreases exponentially with increasing score. So if you believe a model like this, if you double the size of your sequence, you're going to get twice as many, and hold the score constant, level constant, you're going to get twice as many matches. That makes sense. But if you double your score threshold, you will exponentially decrease the number of matches you would expect by chance. So once you build a statistical model and validate this thing, you can do some kind of analysis of the meaning of the scores. And thus, when you ask for, I want a sequence, I want to know about all matches, you can ask, I want to know how rare these matches are by chance, in terms of statistical sense, rather than how good are they by score. Okay, and it helps you assess significance and things like that. Any questions? So if you're a statistician, you spend a lot of time worrying about these things, okay, and trying to interpret the meaning of these things. your biologist, you look for a high meaningful, how meaningful your score is when you get a database hit, not just what match. Any questions? Okay. Thanks for your attention. Next class we're going to go, this is all I want to say about string comparison. Next class we're going to start to look at a different class of problems on sequences, those related to gene recognition. How do we predict where there are genes in sequences? Thanks a lot. Talk to you next class. Thank you.